In the Civil Rights Act of 1968, America does move forward. And the bell of freedom rings out a little louder.
This is A Little Louder, a podcast for wonks, housers, and rabble-rousers, where we talk about fair housing, community development, and how we can use these issues to build people power and work toward equity and justice. I'm Michael D. Plan. A major topic of this podcast has always been evictions. As we get into 2024 now, crazy to say, but as we get into the new year, evictions are still a topic that we are focused on as we see how we can limit these life-changing events. Joining us today on the show is Andrew Nelson, Associate Professor of Anthropology at University of North Texas, who is currently researching housing justice. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thanks, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about how an anthropology professor has come to research housing justice?
Sure. I'll tell you a little bit about my initial research into housing, which is on a different continent, but then how I got into studying the subject here in North Texas. So I'm an applied cultural anthropologist, and my main interests in like kind of very general terms are urbanism and migration. And so my doctoral research dealt with housing in Kathmandu, Nepal, where I studied the conversion of land from an agrarian economy to one much more based on real estate. So in that process, as you know, you would expect, housing costs and land prices went way up, right? Which caused all kinds of injustices to tenants, right? Most of whom were migrants from the more rural areas of the country. But in a place where folks don't expect much from the state, what I found really interesting in my dissertation was, you know, how good they were at organizing and self-organizing to demand rights for land, for housing justice, et cetera. And some of those lessons, I think, in organizing could be applied, could be learned here in the States and Texas and generally in the global North. So in addition to that, I'll say one more word about anthropology. You know, what distinguishes us from, say, the other social sciences that might be studying evictions, like such as a geographer or an economist or a sociologist? We're more interested in cultural meaning making, right? And so to be brief, you know, my interests here are in what does housing mean to people? What does eviction and housing justice mean, right? So not just strictly in a political economic sense, but also an experiential or symbolic sense of the word. And then I'll add a word about being an applied anthropologist. That means that, you know, I intend for my research not just to be put in some peer-reviewed publication that'll be read by 20 other people and go be stuck in a library, but something that will hopefully be used, right, and applied and, you know, translated for use by an organization, by lawyers, by tenants' unions, et cetera.
Yeah, I think this sort of speaks to the universal nature of something like eviction, that someone can be in Nepal and experiencing something that we're experiencing here in the state of Texas. Well, actually, that was my next question for you is, so how did you get from studying this in Nepal all the way back to Denton?
Yeah. So it really comes down to the question of organizing for housing rights. I became very interested in tenants' unions, I think about the time about the pandemic. I mean, like a lot of folk, I think the pandemic drew our attention to housing injustice in the States, particularly here in North Texas. And so here in Denton, a little bit into the pandemic, a group called the Denton Autonomous Tenants Union emerged, or DATU. And they emerged in response to the epic snowvid of February 2021, or, you know, the freeze. And so it was really interesting. They were able to collect thousands of dollars to contribute to tenants who were essentially left to their own devices because their management, the company, all took off, right? They pulled a bunch of Ted Cruz's and went off to Oklahoma or wherever it may be, somewhere warmer, maybe Cancun, leaving the tenants alone to, you know, figure things out on their own. And the union stepped in and helped immensely with some of those efforts, right? Unfortunately, the union did not last. It was disbanded, I believe, early 2022. But, you know, attending their meetings, getting to know some of the folks there got me interested in what does it mean to organize around quality of life issues, right? And, you know, I think theoretically speaking, this is super interesting because I think we're moving as a society. And again, I go back to my experience in Nepal, and I think in some ways they're way ahead of us in asking this question. But in getting us to move from a kind of a traditional model for leftist organizing, which is, you know, based on labor, production, and thinking more about quality of life issues. And I mean, honestly, I think housing, there's no better place to start, right, in addressing a major need, particularly here in Texas, all throughout the states, too. On a more personal note, I'd say also I've got to give a shout out to my students, because I think they inspired me to research housing issues. Again, during the pandemic, I think that's the time when students started opening up to me more about their housing struggles. Based on what they've told me, I've done a couple student-led research projects on housing inequality, and the results have just been absolutely mind-boggling. The situations that these students find themselves in, I mean, I think we'll probably get into some of these situations I'll get to talk about with questions down the line here, but obviously, when you have a temporary population, right, a collection of temporary tenants, management companies don't, and also in a very much a renter's market in a college town, right? Landlords and management companies don't have to do much to keep tenants from protesting and organizing against them.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, which is the traditional way that at least, you know, the United States and similar places organize, which is organizing around labor versus organizing around quality of life. What is organizing around quality of life look like? How does that sort of, because I think we all know the traditional way of organizing around labor is, you know, maybe withholding labor or demonstrating the strength of why labor is important. But what is organizing around quality of life look like? How does that happen?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? You know, it's withholding rent is a kind of one basic first step. Unfortunately, in Texas, there isn't the right to redemption, right? There isn't the right to withhold your rent. But, you know, I'm sure we'll get into the pro-business laws of Texas, right? Our pro-landlord laws here. But it can be a number of other creative actions, right, that tenants' unions can do. I mean, one is just kind of, I think, knowing your rights seminars, right? So going out to apartment complexes, and this is one, you know, really interesting outcome of collecting this data that we've been doing, is we're able to identify where are the hotspots, where are the, in the eviction lab, of course, it's for Dallas and Fort Worth, you know, where are those like serial evictors, right? And those are the complexes that you want to hit first and try to get people on the same page in terms of recognizing eviction and the threat of eviction, not as an individual personal problem, but rather one that, you know, this is the company that's doing it, right? And getting people to identify ways in which, you know, their collective voice is going to be much stronger in responding to the management than, say, one person going against the company.
So you laid the sort of foundation of what certain pockets of Denton are like, that it's somewhat temporary. Or at least a lot of the populace is like our temporary renters. But I would love for you to sort of tell us, what do we need to know about Denton and Denton County? Like, what is the environment like for, of course, for housing in general, but also for making advancements for tenants, for renters in Denton? What is the environment like there?
Yeah, sure. I can give a little bit of the context of the county and more specifically the city. I should start by explaining that my observations here are based on 2 years of research in which we were collecting data from Denton County courts for the entire county, from the Justice of Peace courts here. But we've shifted when we started doing the analysis. And when I say we, I should give a shout out to my graduate student research assistants, AJ Thomas, Michaela Williams, Fallon Marsh, and Purnima for their help with this project. And so when we started doing the analysis, we realized that we couldn't handle Denton County. So like, okay, let's just focus on Denton City, the place where we live, where UNT is, et cetera, right? But I can give a bit of the context, first the county, and then I'll zero in more on the city of Denton. So in some ways, you know, Denton County is your typical suburban county in Texas, right? Still very much economically dependent on Dallas or Fort Worth. But the unique thing is that this, you know, whereas a lot of the population is in the southern part of the county, you know, Carrollton, Flower Mound, over into even Southlake and Roanoke, the center is Denton, right, to the north. So moving away from the major cities of Dallas and Fort Worth. But, you know, in that kind of makeup, you have extreme economic disparity between, you know, you have this kind of pockets of wealth going over to the east to the Frisco side, down south to Flower Mound, South Lake, Roanoke. But then, you know, along the core, the kind of the I-35 core from, say, Louisville up to Denton, it's still very much working class, very much lots of rental housing, very much service industry oriented, right? And so I think the city of Denton, all of that applies even more so, right? Because it is a college town. You have Texas Women's University with, say, I don't know, 15, 16,000 students. You have University of North Texas, UNT, with, I think the latest number I heard is 47,000 students. Wow. You know, and obviously they don't all live, not all those 65,000 students live in Denton, but, you know, it creates an immense need for temporary housing, right? So it's a renter's market without any doubt. You know, last time I checked, the number was around 53% of housing stock was rental. So much higher than, say, you know, other particularly suburban areas in DFW. And, you know, there's more ethnic and racial diversity in the surrounding areas for sure. You have rapid rental cost increases over the last 10 years. When I moved here in 2012, I believe one bedroom apartment was going for around $500, $550, right? Now in 2024, just the other day, I saw an estimate that said it's at $1,300 for a one bedroom, you know, which is probably a bit on the high side. So it's, you know, nonetheless, $1,150, $1,200, it's more than doubled in the last decade, yes. Right? And as we know, wages have not doubled. In fact, nowhere near that, right? If they've grown at all. Additionally, I think it's important to point out that the city of Denton doesn't have much, well, relatively little infrastructure for social services, very little affordable housing. We did pass a bond measure in the November election for $15 million for affordable housing. It's yet to see what's to come of that. And then finally, I want to make a, you know, make a note here about the university. I can't speak much about TWU, but I work at UNT, and just say that, you know, listening to my students, UNT is growing super fast. I mean, we're adding 2,000-3,000 students per year, right, on top of the standard number. And we have this requirement where first-year students have to live on in the university dorms, right? But the university is growing so quickly that they can't provide the student dorms to the first-year students. Right. And so there's a huge market for what people are calling private dorms. You know, these are really common in your college towns across the states. You know, your Madison, Columbus, places like Austin, right? There's one company in particular called American Campus Communities. So I'm slowly learning more about, they're actually owned by Blackstone Investment. So, you know, super financialized, right? And, you know, these places usually, well, I can talk about the American Campus Communities. They have three buildings here or complexes here in Denton with probably 600 to 1,000 residents per building, per complex. And they function very much like a dorm, right? So you get, you pay for one room, and then you have your shared area where you share it with three or four other strangers, very much like a university dorm. You know, you don't necessarily get to pick who you live with. But unlike a dorm, there's no dining hall, right? There's no resident assistant to help with social conflicts. You know, there's less safety. There's no key card to enter the complex. And there's really no accountability if something goes wrong, right? If you're in a UNT dorm, there's accountability if something goes wrong. The institution has to answer for it, right? But not in the private dorm. You know, instead, they offer the appeal of swimming pools, Friday night parties, study rooms, things like
that. That might sound great to a, you know, 19-year-old.
Exactly.
They're missing the forest for the trees, I suppose.
Well, exactly. And you know, from the projects we've done with students, we find out that the Friday night parties don't actually exist, right? And the swimming pool isn't maintained, right? And, you know, on top of that, they're more expensive than the subsidized UNT dorms. And let me just finish. I pull up one quote from our research. This is just tells the situation so well. This comes from the UNT off-campus housing website. Many student apartments are in very poor condition. While your student, this is speaking to parents, while your student may not expect luxury, they should be safe and comfortable.
There might be some, I guess, missing information from the safety and comfort of an off-campus dorm.
Yeah.
Now, you are not just, I guess, studying the housing specifically, but you're also studying evictions. So what were some of your findings, or like high level sort of like trends or, you know, commonalities? What did you discover in researching the eviction?
Sure. Yeah, I can talk through the kind of two sides of the project. And I should explain that, you know, this project's still very much in its infant stages. Right now, we're just trying to get a handle on the bigger data. So we're doing quantitative analysis based on court records. We keep an archive of every case, every eviction that's filed with Denton County. And then we're also doing qualitative research, right, where we go and attend eviction courts, the JPs, mostly in the Denton City area. Right. But then we hope to ultimately get to more ethnographic projects where we understand more about, you know, what's the experience of eviction. But, you know, in general, to start with the quantitative data, I think, you know, one thing we find that's different from, say, you know, your Houston or your San Antonio, which have, you know, eviction rates in like the, you know, 10 plus in some cases, yes, range, right? 10% plus, super, super high, you know, where one out of 10 rental units is facing eviction. It's absurd. In Denton, we're looking at probably 5 to 6%. But having said that, it makes me wonder, you know, what is eviction, right? And how, what do we mean by this term eviction? And I think even though the rate is lower, you know, 5 to 6%, I think there's a lot of informal evictions going on. So your colleague, Ben Martin at Texas Housers, turned me on to the work of Philip Garboden and Ava Rosen, some sociologists who've done this really cool research on like kind of asking what does eviction mean, right? It's not just a single act of displacement, but rather it's the threat of eviction, right? It's the tactic of extracting fees, intimidating tenants to disempower them, ultimately turning tenants into debtors, right? And so by this definition, I think this is what's going on, particularly with the students here, right? That, you know, tactics like really high late fees, leases that seem to always be changing, pressure to sign leases very quickly without the time to really look at them, the inability to see a model unit, et cetera, right? These are all tactics to intimidate tenants, specifically student tenants, right? So, you know, back to the quantitative data, in addition to those lower rates, we certainly see pockets of high rates, right? And, you know, you wouldn't be surprised. These are the places where students are. It's the places where we have affordable housing units in Denton. We're finding in the data that for the most part, you know, up to one quarter of evictions or eviction filings here in Denton City, one quarter of them come from a single address in Austin, right? Mm-hmm. And so we trace this address back to a couple eviction companies. Like perhaps you've heard of Nationwide. I think they're called Nationwide Compliant, yeah, Agents or something, right? It used to be Nationwide Evictions. And so essentially they're like, you know, they handle evictions, right? They negotiate evictions for these companies. And so that's going on, right? This idea that eviction is becoming this kind of profiteering business in addition to the financialization of apartment complexes. And that kind of leads into JPs, so Justice of the Peace Courts, and what we're seeing there. So interestingly enough, we noticed a decline in eviction filings between 2022 and 2023. So not only in filings, but also, you know, the rate of victories for plaintiffs or landlords. So we went from 72% in 2023 to 56% in 2023. Overall, filings went from about 1,500 in 2022 to about 1,250 in 2023. So it's like, what's going on here? And it became pretty obvious. I didn't have to think too hard about this, but there was a change in the judge, right? Which really reveals the inconsistency of JP practices. And that's another project for me down the road, to understand the history of JPs in the eviction process, because it is so inconsistent. Previously, I did research on a site when I was doing more work on immigration. I would attend asylum court hearings, and it's exactly the same, right? Your chance of winning your case as a migrant or an asylum applicant or a tenant have to do so much with the judge, right? And very little to do with the actual merits of your case. So in 2022 election, we had one JP1 here in Denton, Joe Holland, stepped down. He's actually now on the Denton City Council. Make of that what you want. And we actually didn't, the first year of doing our qualitative observations in JP court, we weren't tracking the time that cases would take. I wish we did. We're going to start doing this in 2024. But I would just venture a guess that his like kind of rate was about 2 to 3 minutes per case. He was super, super fast. Get him in, get him out, make those decisions very quickly. And then in steps, Alan Wheeler, who replaced him, also Republican. I mean, all six of the JP's judges here in Denton County are Republican. We had one Democrat until 2022, Christopher Lopez, who actually took his time on cases, usually about 15 to 20 minutes per case for him. At any rate, Wheeler steps in and, you know, he talks up the defendants. He gets them, you know, tries to make them comfortable in his court. And he's more willing to ask questions about, okay, how did you do the notice to vacate, right? How did you put the notice up? How did you inform the tenant? So there's been a lot more dismissals. So, you know, it depends so much on the judge, right? And if you want, I could get into more about the qualitative observations that we've been.
I would love to hear more about like some of your, the qualitative side of JP court, you know. Texas Housers has spent a lot of time in JP courts in Houston and, you know, Harris County and some time in San Antonio courts as well, Bexar County. And, you know, a lot of what you're saying, you know, rings pretty familiar. You know, it depends. Unfortunately, it depends on a lot of the JP. It depends on the geography of things, right?
Yeah.
Where a landlord chooses to file.
Yeah.
You know, because a landlord can file with a JP that the landlord knows will be a sub 5 minute eviction.
Right. Yeah.
So it really kind of depends on, unfortunately, you know, a geography and elections, you know, who is elected to these JP courts. But just coming from an anthropological background, I would be really curious as to the qualitative side of what your research has been.
Sure. Yeah. I can give you some snippets from our observations. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that we found, I mean, I'm sure you see this across the board, particularly in the bigger cities. And I mentioned this before, the inconsistency of courtroom practice, right? And I think this speaks to the fact that, you know, it's a political position, right? It's not necessarily based on one's legal training or education or any of those factors, but it's party based. And as I mentioned before, all six JPs in Denton County happen to be Republican. So, you know, just to give some examples of our six judges, and this was in 2022 when the diversion program was still in effect. We still had an eviction diversion program. Of the six, only two would ever mention that the fact that we had a diversion program and offer it as a possibility, right? Only one of those six would offer any sort of, you know, unsolicited advice to defendants about relief agencies or what's possible, right? Oh, maybe ask these folks. The other five never, ever mentioned those possibilities. And also that judge was the only one to ever really give the time and attention to the notice to vacate question, right? Like really kind of quizzing or grilling the plaintiff representative on, you know, how did you give notice to vacate, right? Which is so, so key. So there's that. But then, you know, kind of just kind of the more kind of vagrant exceptions here. I mean, I actually had a judge shushing defendants in court, right? Like, you know, telling them, shut up. This is my turn to speak, right? I do not want to hear from you. And then I love the bit where they say, you know, only speak if you have a legal reason for what you're about to say, right? Or a legal claim. Of course, you know, 99.5% of tenants don't know what the legal claim is because that information is not provided to them before they enter the court, right? So they have to be a pretty quick study sitting there in the benches watching other cases, right? So anyways, you know, you have the judge shushing the defendant on one hand, and then turning to the plaintiff and saying, take the rent, take the money. You can take the money and still evict them. It's a win-win for you, right? So giving unsolicited advice to the other side, right? I mean, it reminds me of, you know, all these scholars often refer to Texas laws. We mentioned earlier how Texas housing laws tend to be pro-business, business-friendly. I mean, that's very much a euphemism in my opinion. You know, here's a, sorry if I'm gonna go off on an editorial rant here, but this is a place where we can learn a lot from, you know, the right-wing use of language, right? You know, to go from anti-abortion to pro-life, right? We could learn a thing or two from that. You know, it's not necessarily pro-business. I mean, surely it is, but, you know, it's anti-tenant is what it is.
Yes. I mean, the way you use language is very important.
Yeah.
And simply parroting what may not be in your best interest, but has sort of become the language of the day is not necessarily the best thing when you're trying to effect change. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, pro-business is a very polite way of saying that the laws are made by largely people who do not want tenants to be empowered. And they're often made by lobbies or organizations that may not even be residents of Texas. Yeah. They're not even Texans, yet they're affecting millions of Texas renters.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to take a lot of work, yes, but it's also going to take like a cultural shift, which I think you could probably speak to as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I've got a lot to say about that for sure. I think you're so right that it does take a fundamental shift in how we define housing, right? And the right to housing in our country, for sure. Let me say a few more things about, if you got a few more court case stories for you here. That same judge, after giving the advice to the plaintiff, turns around and says to the defendant, you've been evicted past tense, right? It's over. This case is closed. And, you know, here's the interesting thing, too, from kind of relationship emphasis in the research. And this is something I'm hoping to start research, ethnographic research with management companies, with those representatives, because oftentimes we see that there is a kind of a very close relationship, well, not necessarily a close relationship, but a decent relationship between the management representative and the tenant, right? They're on a first name basis. The management is almost always willing to take a late payment there in court, settle it before they come to the bench, right? Do things like that. But then they'll turn to the judge and say, well, corporate made me do it, right? Sorry, you know, my management tells me I can't accept this by money order. I can't accept a check. I can't do this A, B, C, and D, right? I can't take partial payment, et cetera, right? And that's where, you know, in these cases, when there are those kind of moments for possibility, the JP, unfortunately, has stepped in to kind of close off that potential and say, no, you've been evicted past tense. This is over. Plaintiff, you can take the money if you want, but this person has been evicted.
And, you know, we were speaking about how, you know, JPs are elected. It's also of note. So JPs, while they get guidance from the state overseeing body of judges, they are not bound to really any oversight. They have a lot of independence to conduct their court the way they want to. So if they want to just have a very familial relationship with the landlords or management companies that come in and they want to shush a defendant, they can do that. There's really very little recourse in how a judge runs their court because they were sort of elected to that position, and that's kind of the way it is. Now, on the flip side of that, judges can act in a very informative way to the defendant. They can tell them of all the things that are available to them. They can be very understanding to how the laws are interpreted to those who are having the eviction filed against them. So it really depends upon, I guess, the kind of folks who are running for these positions. And that's why these elections on the JP level, which really flies very under the radar, are very important just to the sort of foundation and cultural fabric of a community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Michael, because, yeah, I think you're right. That flexibility, that lack of transparency opens us up to the possibility of abuse on one hand, for sure, and inconsistency, but also, I mean, the possibility of organizing for tenants' rights. I should mention that one of the JPs here in Denton County, unfortunately, the one who lost in 2022, the one Democrat, he did take the time to, you know, probably 10 minutes spiel at the beginning of every session to explain certain things to tenants specifically. And on top of that, every Wednesday afternoon, he would have a pro bono legal advocate lawyer sitting outside the court, just waiting, right, to talk to tenants about their cases.
Yes. And, you know, that's one of the things that we're seeing in Houston. We're seeing like eviction prevention specialists, folks who are working with a lot of these tenants who, this is something that we say often at Texas Housers, you know, the tenant who goes to eviction court, that's probably the first time they've ever been to an eviction court. But the plaintiff, whether it be a liaison for management or a landlord themselves, they've probably been there multiple times. They likely know the judge. They know how the proceeding is run. So there's an automatic imbalance of justice as soon as the tenant walks in. And it is incumbent upon not just organizations like ours, which are concerned with housing, but anyone who's interested in justice mm-hmm. to want to make sure to balance those scales. I mean, because if you're in criminal court, you have the option to be appointed an attorney, and that's just not the case in many other legal arenas, whether it be immigration court or asylum court or family court does, but other courts that aren't within the criminal court sphere, mm-hmm. eviction court being one of them. No, eviction is a life-changing event, and the folks who are experiencing it are often not as educated to the ways of eviction as those who are filing it or carrying it out. Right. So how can we rebalance those scales to make them equal?
I think to start, legal representation is so huge, right? We know that makes such a big difference if a defendant has a representation, right? So some sort of public support for that, I think, is a huge start. But there's so much can be done. The diversion programs made a big difference during the pandemic, right? I would love to see the continuation of those. Extended periods for right to cure for tenants, right? More time, just increased opportunity to keep the case from entering court, right? Because like you said, once it gets to the court, it's so imbalanced towards the people who have been there before, right? And have those personal relationships with the JPs. Yeah, it's pretty clear, right? Another thing that drives me crazy is how cheap it is to file an eviction in Texas, right? That's another one. One of those, pro-business, business-friendly sort of parts of the law that could certainly take a second look at.
So we talked a little bit about how some of the eviction diversion programs statewide or even, specific to Denton have gone away. Have you seen that, the absence of that, affect the rise of evictions? Like, is there just like a direct correlation there?
Not as much as I expected. At first, the answer is definitely yes, right? So, I believe, at least here in Denton City, the last sources of relief disappeared early spring 2023. Much of it was gone. It was definitely not being talked about in the JP courts, the eviction courts, second half of 2022. So we did see an increase at the end of 2022, somewhere between 20 to 30 more cases being filed per month. We saw rulings for the plaintiff definitely increase from the 60s into the mid 70s at the end of 2022. And that continued into the start of 2023. And then all of a sudden, at around June 2023, and we're still kind of sorting through this data, we see a decline, right? And, like I said before, I can't help but just attribute that to the change in judge that happened, right? And that's just a difference. JP1 being the largest court of the city of Denton. Now, there are two other JPs, but that's the biggest one.
Here at Housers, we are more in the bigger cities of Houston, San Antonio, Austin, obviously Dallas, and then maybe some Fort Worth, Tarrant mm-hmm. County. But why do you feel it's important to understand what's happening in cities like that, and more yeah. mid-sized cities, and how they differ from a bigger city? Like, what do you think is the sort of key differences there, and why is it important to explore those places?
Yeah. What you said about the JPs, I think, lends itself also to a town like Denton, a mid-sized city that's surrounded by, larger metropolitan areas, in that, the amount of lack of transparency or lack of awareness in JPs allows for some abuses, but also some opportunities, right? And I think the same applies here in Denton, right? There's not much attention at all on housing. In fact, I'll give you one story. And again, Ben Martin and I talked a lot about this because he got involved on the back end of this story. But I was working with a local journalist in the Denton Record Chronicle to do a story based on my research into evictions. And he took my research and then, you know, did his due diligence and interviewed other people, including a former JP here. And he got into his head that it's the problem is it's affordable housing or it's tenants' rights, right? That's the issue for the city to decide, as if like this is an either or question. You can only support affordable housing or you can only support tenants. And you know, Ben and I are like, well, this is a both and question, right? As far as we're concerned. And so I think, you know, oftentimes you do get kind of these silly debates going on in a small town like this, right? And unfortunately, from what I can tell, you know, the little bit of advocacy work I've done here in the city and talking to other activists, you know, the city is very focused on affordable housing right now, particularly in dealing with the homeless population or the unhoused population here in Denton, which, you know, that's great. And we did pass the bond, you know, $15 million at least to do something about it, right? So hopefully that will get better. And yet I think tenants' rights just gets completely left out of the conversation, right? So, I mean, I think the politics here are a little bit more subtle, but I think there's more opportunity, right, to make a bigger impact because it doesn't take as much to make a big difference, say, compared to a case like Dallas, right, where you probably need a much more kind of cohesive movement to make a difference. You know, like I said, there was a tenants union here, and there's a couple of groups now that are forming, particularly, you know, former UNT students that have emerged out of either workers' rights, or there's another group, Abundance Denton, that's focusing more on land rights and tenants' rights. So, you know, the possibilities there to do things. You know, I would love to see more scrutiny on the JPs. I think that's a first step because, again, you know, I don't know. I haven't been to a JP in Dallas, so I don't know this for sure, but I would imagine they're more used to having observers attend their court, right? And they're going to watch what they say a bit more, right? Here in Denton, when I show up, when my research assistants show up to observe court, the judges don't know what to do with us. They're like, what are you doing here? Why are you here? And, you know, usually I have to go talk to them afterwards, do a little bit of damage control. Like, I'm just observing, right? There's nothing to be afraid of here, right? But I think it shows that insecurity, right? Or they've grown used to the lack of accountability or lack of regulation. So I think that's, you know, a huge step. And there are, you know, things that a city council can do, you know, very, very quickly, you know, such as try to make the process a little bit better for tenants, a little more information, for instance, on a court summons, you know, send them information about what's possible to them. And then I'll add one thing about the university. I mean, I think that's another interesting element of a college town like Denton, is that, you know, you have multiple institutions to go to, right? It's not just city council where you're going to go to demand something, but also the university here. You know, as I mentioned before, it's a public university that provides housing for some, right? For the most part, it's outsourcing this need to house all of these, you know, thousands of new students every year, right? And that's creating a lot of problems. So that's another kind of back-end situation I'm working with to, you know, work with the dean of students here. And we had, you know, a few small victories here. I mean, things like the dean of students created emergency housing units in the dorms. You know, so if a student is facing a night in their car, they can go and find a room in one of the dorms at least. Now we have sleeping pods in the union. I mean, these are very small or incremental sort of stuff. But, you know, it's easier to get a meeting with that person who's going to listen to you, say, in a small town like Denton than somewhere bigger.
And, you know, For the folks who are suggesting it's either affordable housing or tenant rights, you know,
yeah,
or, you know, working through affordable housing or working through evictions, I mean, I would charge you to speak with, you know, an unhoused person and, you know, ask them, have they ever self-evicted or had a formal eviction? And the answer is probably yes. And that shows the connectivity between those two ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to just do our best, at least I would think it, using the sort of like instruments of government, we do our best to seek out, you know, expertise, information, lived experience. All of these things will teach you that both affordable housing and tenant rights are inextricably linked. And we should do our best to repair these things simultaneously rather than tend to one and leave the other to starve.
Yeah.
So what is next for you and your team?
A couple of things. As I mentioned before, I want to dig more into the ethnographic, right? This is where we get to a little bit more of that. Those anthropological questions are going to emerge in our research about the meaning of housing justice. So in particular, I'm thinking about a couple of things. One, I want to do a historical study on JPs in Texas, do some archival work there to understand, you know, how this institution came to have so much power in the housing process. You know, the other thing, we want to get a little bit more at the nuances of housing court, like, say, measure the average time per case. I think that's very, very telling about the process. And then in terms of the ethnography, we're going to start with a project with these larger complexes, right? Particularly the student, the private dorm complexes. And, you know, on one hand, try to understand their pressures, right? So understand, you know, what is the impact of financialization on their decision-making? You know, where are their demands coming from, their commands from above? And then what are the relationship to the tenants, the students in their building? And then also working with students and other tenants to see how my research can better organize, say, a tenants union or some kind of movement to have something a little more systematic in the observations of JPs, you know, more pressure on city council, more pressure on the university to make a difference.
If our audience wants to find out more about your work or contact you, how should they access all of that?
Yeah, the best place would be my website through UNT. So if you go to UNT Anthropology and you put in Andrew Nelson, you'll definitely find me and you can see my publications. Not so much on evictions yet, right? That's still in the making, but hopefully the next couple of years we'll have more on that.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew Nelson, for joining us on A Little Louder this week.
Well, thanks, Michael. I really appreciate it. And, you know, for what it's worth, you know, these podcasts are huge. I use at least two or three of them in my class every year, in my class on urban anthropology. And I think they're perfect for me, right? Because they use, like, they'll have someone who knows the theory, knows the history, right? But then applies to a very local case that my students can relate to, having been, you know, residents for most of their lives in Texas.
Well, I'm so glad that we could have you on the show. That'll do it for this episode of A Little Louder. JT Herrichmack will play us out, and we will see you next time. Bye for now. I don't wanna have a worry. I don't have a care. I haven't got a thing to call my own. Though I'm out of money, I'm a millionaire. 'Cause I've still got my home.